Welcome to the First Century Church Podcast. My name is Stephen Wilhoy, and I'm the lead pastor at First Century Church, and it is an honor to have you with us today. The goal of the podcast is simple. We want you to be encouraged, challenged, and inspired to go further in your faith than ever before. If you'd like more information about the church, you can visit our website, firstcenturykc.com. And if you happen to be in the Kansas City area anytime soon, we'd love to have you join us for one of our live gatherings to connect with you in person. Again, thanks for joining us today, and we hope that you enjoy today's message. So how many of you would agree with this following statement? Life is hard. Anybody disagree with that statement? No hands. All right, so that was easy. I think that's a universally agreed upon maxim. Life is hard. On so many different levels, it's just a grind, isn't it? It's just making it through is sort of sometimes the goal of some days or some weeks or some seasons in life. And so as we're now in week 8 of our series Complex, Job is also going to absolutely agree with that statement. Life is hard. We spent the last couple of weeks, as his friends have now come to join him in his suffering and sit with him in chapters 4 and 5, his friend Eliphaz has given his opening speech to Job. And as we discovered, pretty harsh words from a friend, pretty useful things that he said, unhelpful advice that he gives. And so now in chapter 6 and chapter 7, Job is going to respond to his friend Eliphaz here. And so in some ways, he's responding directly to his friend, yes, in these chapters. And also in some ways, he's connecting back to what he's already said in his opening lament. And he's going to talk to his friends. He's going to sort of talk to God, as we'll see. It's sort of a jumble here with Job and all of his emotions. But I think also he's had time to sort of think a little bit more as his friend's been talking about his situation. He's had time to maybe sit in his pain a little bit more. And so what Job is going to first declare in this section of Job is the harsh reality of life. That not only on really your best days are there unpredictabilities that make life difficult, even in good times, there's just things that happen, roadblocks, speed bumps, that you just can't predict and deal with all that's happening. But with what Job specifically is facing is really beyond comprehension. So let's start at the beginning of Job chapter 6 and look at how he opens his response to his friend Eliphaz here in Job 6 verses 1 through 4. Then Job answered and said, "Oh, that my vexation were weighed and all my calamity laid in the balances, for then it would be heavier than the sand of the sea. Therefore my words have been rash. For the arrows of the Almighty are in me. My spirit drinks their poison. The terrors of God are arrayed against me." So as you can tell, this is going to be kind of a darker message today, but we'll see some light at the end of our tunnel before we're done. But what Job is experiencing here, he's describing, this is more than I can handle. He says, my grief is so deep. If it were weighed on the scale, the scale would just break in pieces. It just couldn't handle the weight of what I'm carrying. The key word there in verse 1 is this word vexation. And it's this Hebrew word kahas. And this simply means anger, frustration, grief, kind of mixed with worry. You sort of bite your lip and pace back and forth because something's really heavy on your mind. Or you're sitting around just constantly putting things in your mind over and over about what might happen or what has happened or what should have happened or why didn't that happen. It's all this sort of bubbling emotion going through Job here. This is a fairly rare word in the Old Testament. It only comes up about 24 times in total. It's used in different types of contexts. And this specific way this word's used here is only shows up in about 6 other verses in the entire Old Testament. Probably the most famous example other than this one is in 1 Samuel chapter 1, where this woman named Hannah expresses this word. And so I'll mention this. I have this book here. Our very own Pam Enderby has written a book based on this section that I'm going to talk about for just a minute. So if you want a really good sort of devotional take on this topic, ladies, you got this at the women's conference. And so men, if you're here and you don't have this, you can grab them. We have some on the table back there. But she does a great treatment of this story in 1 Samuel 1. But Hannah here is unable to bear children. That's her main issue that causes this vexation in her. And so she deals with the grief and emptiness, probably anger over this issue. This is really sort of a social no-no for her. And she can't help it, but it's still sort of a black mark against her. Not only that, but her husband has another wife, and she is on her case all the time, putting her down because she can't bear children to her husband. It's so shameful. It's so terrible. And so they go to the temple, the tabernacle at this time every year for prayer. And when Hannah goes this year, she is so weighed down. She is praying to God. She is agonizing. And she promises God. She vows God this. She says, God, if you will give me a son, I will give him back to you forever. What she says. But she's in this mode. I mean, she's probably ugly crying, and the mascara is running, and the snot's flowing, and she's just sort of in a, you know, just here in a mass in a heap on the floor. And the priest sees her kind of in this condition, and he thinks that she's drunk. So he approaches her and says, whoa, 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 no, we're not going to desecrate the tabernacle like that. Get out. But look at what Hannah says back to him. 1 Samuel 1:16. She says, do not regard your servant as a worthless woman. For all along, I've been speaking out of my great anxiety and vexation. She uses the same word here that Job is using here in Job chapter 6. This deep grief, this anger, this frustration. And she makes this vow to God. She tells the priest that. He says, okay, go home. And so a year later, less than a year later, she has a son named Samuel. And then sometime after that, she takes Samuel back to the tabernacle and literally gives him to the Lord. He lives in the tabernacle with the priest and becomes what I really consider the first proper national prophet of the nation of Israel. But she's in this season of vexation just like Job has been here. And the main thing that Job is frustrated by is how he describes it basically is endless, meaningless agony. Go forward with me to Job chapter 7 now. We're going to go back and forth between these two chapters. I'm not going to say what numbers they are because I don't want the front row to freak out when I say those two numbers together. If you know, you know. But the beginning of Job chapter 7, let's go there and see. He describes endless, meaningless agony. Job chapter 7, verse 1. He says, has not man a hard service on earth? Are not his days like the days of a hired hand? Like a slave who longs for the shadow, like a hired hand who looks for his wages, so I'm allotted months of emptiness, and nights of misery are apportioned to me. When I lie down, I say, when shall I arise? But the night is long, and I toss and turn till dark. My flesh is clothed with worms and dirt. My skin hardens and then breaks out afresh. My days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle and come to their end without hope. Remember that my life is a breath. My eye will never see good again. And then skip down to verse 16 of Job 7. He says, I loathe my life. I would not live forever. Leave me alone, for my days are a breath. This is the harsh reality of Job's life. These two main descriptions, he says, my days are meaningless. He described himself like a slave or a hired hand. But what he looks at, though, even the slave gets a break at night. He's like, I don't get a break at night. The hired hand, they work like a dog, but at the end of the day, they get their wages. I'm here receiving nothing from my suffering. I don't see any point to it. I don't see any meaning in it. And so it takes him deeper into this place. He describes months of emptiness, no meaning, no purpose, no payoff. And then on top of that, it's not just that they're meaningless, but that they're endless, he says. He has long days and even longer nights. He sort of tosses and turns all night. Maybe you've been here before. As soon as you start to doze off, the alarm clock goes off. As soon as your body relaxes, you know, it's like, oh, no, that was the best I could do without clearing my throat. Sorry. So they're endless. Days are endless. Nights are endless. There's no relief for him. And at the same time, though, it seems like these would go against each other. But at the exact same time, he's saying the days are flying by. It's because of the meaninglessness of his suffering that he senses right now. It seems like it's going on forever. When I look back, it's like, whoa, days are going without any hope in the future here. And in verse 16, he says, I loathe my life. It's the harsh reality for Job. Now, when you face situations, do you ever just wish you could escape from it all? Or at least, sort of like Job here, you just wish you could get some relief. It's just a little bit of ease from what I'm dealing with. Job declares this harsh reality of life. And then, in that way, he also now will describe for us in these same chapters this desire for relief from reality. He just wants some relief. Just take the gas, foot off the gas just a little bit here. The question is, though, can he find relief? And if he can, where can he find it? And so we'll spend the next few minutes looking here at a few places in these chapters here in Job where he tries to, maybe he hopes he can, find some relief from the reality, the harshness of reality that he is facing. And really the first place that he looks to try to find relief is in his friends. So I'm sure that a little over a week ago, he saw his friends coming over the horizon. And my guess is that Job was probably like, oh, good, friends. Oh, good. People who get me. People who can encourage me. People who can, maybe they don't have great words of wisdom, but they can just maybe be with me. They can feel what I'm feeling. A friendly face is all I need right now. But even before the second and third friend have said anything, one of the three friends have spoken, Job already realizes that ain't going to happen. They are not going to help me find any relief at all. In fact, they're going to compound the stress that I'm under. They're going to make me feel worse than I already did. And so back in Job 6, he's going to express his great disappointment in his friends. He's going to really let them have it here in some ways, and it's going to get even more intense as their conversation continues in the chapters to come. But back in Job 6, verse 14, he makes this broad statement. He says, "He who withholds kindness from a friend forsakes the fear of the Almighty." If you remember way back in Job, the very first verse of the first chapter of Job, one of the descriptions of Job was that he was a man who feared God. But now that his friends show up, even though he's known by that, even when later in chapter 1 and chapter 2, God describes Job as someone who fears him. His friends come along and they just know more. They can see through the facade of Job. They can, again, like last week, your wickedness has caused this. You deserve it. You must be sinful, wicked, and evil. And so what Job now says to them is, no, you're not showing fear of God because you've withheld kindness from a friend. The Hebrew word he uses here in this verse, the word kindness, is the word chesed, and it's this Hebrew word that means faithfulness and loyalty, and really in this context, a little added dose of pity involved here as well. I would argue that this is one of the most important words in the entire Old Testament, chesed. This theme runs throughout so much of the Old Testament. It is a major theme. In fact, one of the first series that I ever preached at this church back 11, 12 years ago through the book of Ruth, this is the key theme of this story and this book. And so quickly, to show you how important that is and how Job is not receiving that. So Ruth is this woman from Moab. She's not an Israelite, but she's married into an Israelite family through a time of famine in her home country of Moab. So her father-in-law dies. Her husband and brother-in-law both die. And so now there is their mother-in-law and her sister-in-law, and they're there together, and they have no hope. That they can't just go out and do a small business. They can't fend for themselves. In this culture, women are completely reliant upon the men in their lives for survival. And so her mother-in-law, Naomi, hears that the famine in Israel is now over. She's going to move back home and maybe start a new life. But now Ruth and her sister-in-law have this decision to make. What are they going to do? Are they going to stay behind at home as widows in their country? And so Ruth decides to show chesed to her mother-in-law, Naomi. She decides, I'm going to travel with you to a foreign country. So not only is she a woman, strike one, not only is she a widow, strike two, but she's a foreign widow woman. Three strikes, she's out. And yet she goes with her mother-in-law Naomi anyway, shows her this kindness, this extreme loyalty and faithfulness to her. And so then while she's there, she gleans in the fields. The Old Testament law gives provisions for foreigners in the country to be able to, on the corners of the fields, on the edges of the fields, to glean extra crops, basically to eke by a meager survival. And so she does that. But the owner of the field, Boaz, sees her. He's heard about her story that she's come with her mother-in-law, leaving everything behind. There's no hope for her. And so he shows her chesed and gives her more than she even needed, more than he was required to give her. And then they sort of have this sort of kind of love story going on. But really what he's doing, she proposes marriage to him. He's like, no, that's not how this works. Get off your knee, you know. And then he's like, he proposes marriage to her. They live happily ever after. It's all about this chesed. They show this love, this loyalty, this kindness, this faithfulness to each other. And these, in this story of Ruth, are strangers at the beginning doing this for one another. And so the sad thing about Job is, if strangers, in Ruth's case, can show this to one another, why can't Job's best friends show this to him? That's why he's so disappointed in them. You've withheld kindness from a friend, and he's exposing that they are not as righteous as they might appear and pretend to be. And then later in chapter 6 of Job here, he uses an image to show his disappointment. It's a beautiful part, so I wanted to read it, and then we'll explain what it means and why it's such a big deal. But Job 6, verses 15 through 20, there's this imagery he uses to express his disappointment in his friends here. He says this: "My brothers are treacherous as a torrent bed, as torrential streams that pass away, which are dark with ice and where the snow hides itself. When they melt, they disappear. When it is hot, they vanish from their place. The caravans turn aside from their course. They go up into the waste and perish. The caravans of Tema look. The travelers of Sheba hope. They are ashamed because they were confident. They come here and are disappointed." So we usually think of the Middle East, where this story takes place and where the stories in the Bible take place, as like hot desert sand, nothing there. However, there are many areas of the Middle East, it's a large region, that are fertile, that are green. There are even mountainous regions in the Middle East with snow on top of them. Here's an example of that. These are the Zagros Mountains in Iran. Would you imagine that's in the Middle East? It's nuts, but it is. It's there. So Job is describing here that what caravans would do is they would pass by at certain times of the year. As the snow melts, it's going to make these streams of fresh water in the desert. It's going to be pretty handy to know where they are. But he's describing, he says, so again, when my friends came, I thought, oh, great, streams, comfort, you know, pity, help. And then what happens is when the caravan, they're passing through, they run out of water, and one guy in the caravan happens to say, hey, a few miles back where we already came from, I think there's going to be a stream from the mountain. But then they travel backwards to where they came from, and they discover the water has dried up, and they're embarrassed, they're disappointed, there's nothing there. Job is saying, that's what my friends are like. They showed up, I thought, yes, relief from reality, and yet it's dried up. There's no relief from them. There's no hope for them. There's no help from them at all. This imagery is a beautiful way to describe how he feels about his friends. Really, what he's describing is he's surrounded by friends, but he still feels alone. You ever been there before? It's a terrible place to be, where the people who should be in your corner just don't care. They're not there. They're maybe unaware of how blind they are to your situation, but it just leaves you feeling terrible. And then further on in Job 6, he gets even more vulnerable with his friends. So go down to Job 6, 22 and 23. He just gets really honest with them. He says this: "Have I said, make me a gift? Or from your wealth offer a bribe for me? Or deliver me from the adversary's hand? Or redeem me from the hand of the ruthless?" Job's saying, I haven't asked you guys for anything. I didn't even ask you to come. I mean, the book of Job earlier says when his friends heard what had happened, there's no indication he sent out a note saying, hey, come help me. They heard through the grapevine what's happened. We're going to go visit him. He's saying, I'm not asking anything from you, and yet I feel like I'm being such an inconvenience to you. It's not fair how you're treating me. I'm the one suffering. You're making it worse. You're treating me like an enemy almost here. And then in verse 28, he finishes this sort of statement here, and he tells them, here's all I ever wanted. Job 6:28, he says, "But now be pleased to look at me, for I will not lie to your face." This sort of gets back to the overall issue with Job's friends. The major mistake they make and all the things that they do that are wrong and say that are wrong is they saw him as a problem to solve instead of a friend to love. They're trying to figure out philosophically why this has happened. That's not what I need right now, guys. They're trying to figure out religiously, how did you sin? That might be helpful if that were true, but it's not. Can we skip to what's going to be? Can you just be there for me? Can you just help me get some relief here? Can you just be comforters? You're miserable comforters. He's going to say that in a few chapters later on. He said, the only thing I ask of you is look at me. See me. They were so concerned with the specifics and the details and who did what. They just look right past him the entire time. They talk right past him the entire time. So unfortunately, the friends that should have given some kind of relief to Job actually make things worse. It's a terrible shame that Job could not find relief in his friends. So then Job's looking around and he's thinking, I can't find relief anywhere in this life. So then he's thinking, maybe I can find relief in the afterlife. If I can't find any relief here, maybe in the life that is yet to come, I'll find some kind of relief. So back over to Job chapter 7 again, Job 7, verses 8 through 10. He describes how he might find relief this way. Job chapter 7, verse 8. The eye of him who sees me will behold me no more. While your eyes are on me, I shall be gone. As the cloud fades and vanishes, so he who goes down to Sheol does not come up. He returns no more to his house, nor does his place know him anymore. So Job is saying here, I may never get relief in this life, but maybe I'll find relief in the afterlife. It's sort of a strange parallel here, but just hang with me. It's sort of the same thing that Hamlet says in the middle of that play by Shakespeare. I get it. It's weird, but just hang with me. Because Hamlet believes in this play that his father's been murdered by his uncle. And so he's trying to investigate, figure out. He's pretending to go mad to try to play this character so he can sneak around and try to get more information. And so then in the middle, in it's Act 3, Scene 1, he makes this famous to be or not to be speech. Okay, and it's sort of the same thing in I think a pretty major way that Job is dealing with here. So I wanted to read just a section beyond what we know here, but an important section from that scene to kind of build the tension here that Job is going through this same thing. So here's what Hamlet says in Act 3, Scene 1. He says, to die, to sleep, no more. And by a sleep, to say we end the heartache and the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to. 'Tis a consummation devoutly to be wished. To die, to sleep, perchance to dream. Aye, there's the rub. So it's the same idea. Maybe I can find relief in the afterlife. Maybe what's out there is going to be better than what's here. The problem for Hamlet and the problem really for Job is there is so much mystery around the afterlife for Job, he's not quite sure if it's going to be better or not. So the again, another Hebrew word here. We're learning some Hebrew today, several words here. I didn't realize even until just now how much this was, but this is, I think this is the last one. The key word here that he uses is Sheol. So this is the grave, the pit, the underworld. There's a lot that happens in the understanding or the development of the idea of the afterlife in Jewish belief. And if you remember, we started at the beginning, it seems very plausible that Job is very early, like pre-Moses, pre-law, all of that. So he's got a very, very, very basic understanding, we would assume, of what the afterlife looks like. So much mystery to him. So let me just kind of go through quickly a bit of what his belief would be, how it develops over time, how we should maybe view what the Bible says about the afterlife, especially in the Old Testament and right around the time of the Gospels. So the earliest mention of Sheol, even in Genesis, it appears their belief, and probably Job's belief, is that the afterlife is just sort of one big place where all the dead people just sort of end up. It's also known as the abode of the dead. So it's a place of finality. It is the end. It's known as a place of darkness. In many ways, it's known as separation from God in many major ways. And so we see that here in Job 7. Let's look at a couple other scriptures from other wisdom literature here to see the same idea. Psalm 6, verse 5, it says, for in death there is no remembrance of you, of God. In Sheol, who will give you praise? So it's final. There's no presence of God there. And this is a psalmist talking about this. So we'd assume a righteous person, but they had this view, this final sort of finality of death, this one place we go, the place of the dead. Ecclesiastes 9, verse 10 says, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might, for there is no work or thought or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol to which you are going. So they don't have this place like we would think of at this time. Job, I don't think, does either, of sort of this paradise aspect of Sheol. It's like everybody dies and that's just kind of it. And so if that's all there is, Job's thinking, okay, maybe there's going to be some relief in that, but I mean, maybe not. Maybe it's going to be worse than I think. I just don't know much about anything about this idea of Sheol. Now, somewhere along the way, probably exile and after, there's a bit more of understanding of sort of a separation of Sheol, sort of maybe a good place and a bad place sort of thing going on. Daniel 12, verse 2. So Daniel, during the Babylonian exile at the end of this, or the beginning of the 6th century BC, he writes this, many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. So again, we see over time a development of sort of good area of Sheol, bad area of Sheol, place you want to be, place you don't want to be, place for the good, place for the wicked. And then Jesus' teachings also show this separation. So he tells in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 16, he tells the parable of a rich man and Lazarus, a beggar. And so the story goes that this rich man had all this and lived a great life of luxury. And this beggar named Lazarus, not his friend, he rises from the dead, just this man Lazarus. He's a beggar who sits at the rich man's gate, but it seems the rich man just sort of ignores him over and over and over again. And so Jesus says this in Luke 16, 22. Finally, the poor man died and was carried by the angels to sit beside Abraham at the heavenly banquet. So he's dead, but he's kind of in a good place here. The rich man also died and was buried, and he went to the place of the dead. There in torment, so not good, he saw Abraham in the far distance with Lazarus at his side. So we see, even in the teachings of Jesus, a bit of an advancement of the Sheol, more than what Job would have known. And then, to finish this parable, the rich man is in agony and anguish in this heat, in this fire, and he says, Abraham, will you send Lazarus to just dip his finger in water and touch it to my tongue to give me some relief? He's looking for relief in the afterlife too. And Abraham, in this story, tells him, nope. He's like, you live your time of luxury. That's it. You ignored him. Now I'm going to let him ignore you. And so then here's what Jesus says in verse 26. He says, and besides, there is a great chasm separating us. No one can cross over to you from here, and no one can cross over to us from there. So there's this separation now that we see in the teachings of Jesus in the afterlife that Job may not have seen. We have, I think, much more hope in the afterlife than Job would have. So for him to even think, like, that's how bad his situation was. For him to think, okay, this may be even worse, but it's worth the risk. It's worth a shot. If I can just die, maybe I'll suffer less. Maybe I'll be in less pain than I am now. That's a big thing for him to do. And so it continues to develop here until we get really into John's revelation of Jesus and seeing sort of the end of days. But remember, Job doesn't have this understanding. And even with the understanding that we think we have about the afterlife, there are things that we just do not know. There are things that we just cannot know because we haven't been there, done that, you know, don't have a t-shirt yet. So Job's really thinking out loud here. He's hoping against hope that maybe the afterlife will give me some relief. I don't have anything here to give me any hope. I don't have anything here to take the edge off. I need something there. He's hoping against hope that it's better than this life, but there's no guarantee. But really what he's showing us with that is that the afterlife, I don't want us to view the afterlife this way either. The afterlife is not just an escape from the pain of this life. It's a pretty low view of the afterlife, okay? Better than this life. It's actually way, way, way better than that. And the reason it is because of who we will be with in that afterlife. And that leads us to the final place in which Job finally decides to try to place his hope. He tries to find relief in God. Ultimately, he has nowhere else to go. So back to Job chapter 6, verses 8 through 10. Here's what he says. Oh, that I might have my request, and that God would fulfill my hope, that it would please God to crush me, that he would let loose his hands and cut me off. This would be my comfort. I would even exult in pain unsparing, for I have not denied the words of the Holy One. Job finally looks for relief from God. He says, it would fulfill my hope. It would be my comfort. He even says it would please God to crush him. If you remember back in verse 4 of chapter 6, he says, the arrows of the Almighty are in me. So Job has, we'll look at this more in a future week, but Job has such a deep and extreme view of God's sovereignty. It just blows our mind. He's acknowledging that God has done something to him. Or has at least allowed these things to happen to him. Although he would know, he's known for being righteous and upright and blameless and fearing God and turning from evil, as chapter 1 tells us. He believes in God's complete control, even in his pain and loss. So even though he says in verse 4, his arrows are pointed in me, the poison is in me, a few verses later he says, I want to go to him with my request. That's sovereignty at work. He believes that God has caused or allowed his pain and loss. Even if he can't make sense of it, he still trusts in God's sovereignty. And here in verse 8, he talks about his request. As we will see in future weeks more clearly, his only request from God is to sort of have an audience in his courtroom. He wants his day in court with God to tell God ask God some questions, try to get some information. He just wants to talk with God. That's his only request that he has here. And if you remember, we looked at some verses he directed toward his friends later in chapter 6. It's a lot of what Job says can be in a few categories. Some things are directly to his friends only. Some things may be directly to God only. But some things, I think including this passage here, can be seen to be directed at both. So we've already said, he told his friends, I haven't asked you for anything. I haven't wanted anything from you. Just look at me. It's also possible, I would say likely, that he's directing this to God as well. So let's look at it again through this lens. Job 6, 22 and 23. Job says, have I said, make me a gift, or from your wealth offer a bribe for me, or deliver me from the adversary's hand, or redeem me from the hand of the ruthless? Verse 28, but now be pleased to look at me, for I will not lie to your face. I think Job is addressing God here. He's saying, I'm not asking anything from you except an audience with you. I don't want anything from you except for you to look at me. Job is crying out in this anguish to God, and he's just saying, God, see me. Will you look upon me? Will you look at me? And you know what's interesting about this? God is not offended by that at all. In fact, playing the long game, I would argue that is a major reason Jesus entered human history. People are saying, look at me, and God's saying, I will send myself to you. So what is Jesus' response to this cry from Job in Job chapter 6, well over 1,000 years earlier? Here's what it is, Matthew 11, 28 and 30. Jesus says, come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. What is the response of Jesus to our cry, look at me? His response is, come to me. Are you tired? Jesus says, come to me. Are you weary? Jesus says, come to me. Do you feel invisible and unseen? Jesus says, come to me. Do you need rest? Jesus says, come to me. Are you looking for relief from this present reality? Jesus says, come to me. So the ancient Jews would pilgrimage to Jerusalem 3 times a year in their culture for 3 major feasts. And it was Passover, Pentecost, and then the Feast of Booths or Tabernacles. So the section of the Psalms, it's Psalms 120 through 134. They're known as the Songs of Ascent. This is sort of their playlist that they would sing and recite on their way up to Jerusalem. We actually did a series on some of these Psalms 4 or 5 years ago called Pilgrim Songs. The journey to Jerusalem for these travelers was very dangerous. There's natural elements involved. There's cliffs and mountains. There's storms. There's extreme heat. There's wild animals that could attack them on the road. There's other dangers, like bands of thieves were known to, hey, we know there's people traveling to Jerusalem. We're going to be ready for them to rob them on their way. So the people would sing these psalms in faith that God would protect them and preserve them and provide for them as they journey toward Jerusalem. Now, these psalms predate Job by hundreds of years, if we have our timeline correct, but his desire that he expresses in chapter 6 and chapter 7 to find relief in God parallels this idea behind these songs of ascent. And so to close our time together today, what I want to do is read over us today Psalm 121. It's the second of these songs of ascent. And so what I want us to do is kind of receive this today and declare this along with Job, as God is our confidence. We can find relief in him, our hope in him, and only in him. So here's Psalm 121 as we begin to close it and wrap it up today. I lift up my eyes to the hills. Where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord who made heaven and earth. He will not let your foot be moved. He who keeps you will not slumber. Behold, he who keeps Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord is your keeper. The Lord is your shade on your right hand. The sun shall not strike you by day, nor the moon by night. The Lord will keep you from all evil. He will keep your life. The Lord will keep your going out and your coming in from this time forth and forevermore. In life, there are dangers. There is unpredictability. Tragedy could be just one moment away. Even on your best days, you're probably tired and discouraged. But the good news is, like Job, we can find relief in God. We look to the hills where there's danger. There could be an animal. There could be a thief. But where does my help come from? Where does my relief come from? It comes from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. That is our relief from reality. Let's pray as we close today. God, I am sure that there are many here today who are looking and longing for relief. The harsh reality of life has just hit them in the gut yet again. It struck them between the eyes yet again. And so we, like Job, where can I find relief? Where can I find hope? Where can I just get a moment of rest here? And so we pray that we would look to you. Hopefully we have better friends than Job did, but even they are limited in the relief they can give us. We do have hope in the life that is yet to come. We believe that we maybe know more about it than Job did, and so we do long for that day where there will be no more tears and crying and sadness and pain. But even then, that's still then, and this is now. That's going to be great then, but how do I get relief now? God, you promise. You are our relief. As Job declared, I can find it in him. Remind us of that today, that you are the only source of lasting relief. May we hear and respond to those words of Jesus, come to me. May we find rest in him and relief in him. But with that comes a challenge. The challenge is, may we stop long enough to find him. May we stop trying to figure it out long enough to just go to him. May we sit there long enough to rest in him. That's the challenge. Because we're too often trying to do it on our own. We're trying to be too self-reliant. But no, we want to just say, yes, Jesus, I will come to you. Thank you, God, that you are the relief that I need. May we sense your presence even this week in that relief. May we walk in your power this week in that relief like never before and sense your presence in us and through us. Thank you for all those here today. Thank you for all the fathers here today. Give us all a great day, a great week this week in your presence, resting in you. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.